All right. Welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. It's Friday. It means Fridays with Sandy Williams. Let's go to Lynn from O'Connor, Milwaukee. Hey, Lynn, thank you very much for hanging on. You say what?
Well, I'd like to know your opinions on the impact of Trump's 2017 tariffs on $300 billion of goods from China. The $300 billion number was a 2018 figure, but in 2019, it was reported that it cost U.S. consumers $50 billion. And in your opinion, are the tariffs a component of recent or current inflation? And are the cries of inflation and the Fed's response to it just being used to suppress workers' wages? Those are my two questions.
Hang on, because they're great questions, by the way. Sandy, you want to respond?
Well, I do, and they are both great questions. In the first place, I believe that the tariff, the whole tariff campaign that was put on by the Trump administration has contributed to a number of issues. Number one, it hardened the positions between China and the United States diplomatically. Number two, it raised the price of almost every product that is sold in the United States, because almost every product sold in the United States includes Chinese parts. And the option to paying the tariff for the Chinese good was to shift to another manufacturer in another place, which of course cost money. And so there were two other effects on the supply chain. One was an increase in the cost of things in the supply chain, and a second was a disruption of the supply chain. Both of those things have contributed substantially to inflation, because every economist and every policymaker who looks at the current inflation situation will point at the shortages that exist and point out that this inflation was at least initially and is maybe primarily caused by shortages. And many of those shortages, for instance, in the automobile industry, the automobile makers are all announcing their profits for the last year. And all the analysts are reporting that, number one, that the number of automobiles sold in the United States will be at least 8% less than they have been in the past, as the result of the shortage of supplies in the supply chain, and in particular supplies that would have come from China, like chips. And so, yes, in fact, you're right. And I do believe that inflation, you know, the sorry thing is, and I don't think it's a front, I don't think they're pointing at that as a way to suppress wages. But as I've said before, that one of the sorry things about the business cycle is that when the business cycle is on an upswing, other than a job, Tom, Dick, and Mary don't tend to share in the accumulation of wealth that's provided to, in the boom periods, that is provided to people who own assets like shares of stock or real estate. Those are the people whose wealth goes up rather substantially. And the problem in recessions is that the main tool against inflation is the increase in interest rates and the potential risk of a recession, both of which have an impact on Tom, Dick, and Mary's jobs and the security of Tom, Dick, and Mary's jobs. Now, the happy thing right now is that during this period of inflation and this period of job shortage, wages have been going up more than they had been over the past 30 years. And so Tom, Dick, and Mary were beginning to catch up. And my concern is that policies not be implemented to try and keep the people in the middle class from having wages that catch up with costs under the guise of fighting inflation. Now, happily, inflation seem to be getting a grip on inflation. And so far, at least, we've not seen substantial layoffs. We see layoffs announced, but it's been mostly in the tech sector. And employment and unemployment has not gone up in a material sense, and employment remains strong. So I think both your questions are sound. I'm hopeful about the ability of wages to continue to rise in the face of the current circumstances and the edge of what is otherwise a potential recession as part of a soft landing kind of a prognosis, number one. And number two, I definitely think that the tariff imposition of the tariffs was foolish. And I know that we've continued a number of them as the result of the hardening of positions between China and the United States. But the balkanization, the recompartmentalization of the world economy is going to be a problem, just as Brexit has been an economy for Britain.
Lynn?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you. You know, thank you very much for the thoughtful questions, and thank you for listening.
You're welcome. And I just one more comment. Always fly Southwest. I always fly Southwest. Yeah. So don't pick on them.
I wasn't picking on them. I think lots of people do.
Oh, I know.
Lots of people do it. And the reason is they have these nonstop flights from Milwaukee to lots of places. And they have been but their problem is that the lots of places they serve were places that were badly hit by storms, which caused them to have marooned aircraft. So.
Correct.
Yeah. Hey, Lynn, thank you very much for the call. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Let's go to Jake. Hey, Jake, what's going on, man?
So I'm calling to respond to CJ for the end of the hour. And just, you know, CJ's calls remind me of the chaos the Republican Party's been in these past couple of years. You know, it's the 2-year anniversary of their attack on the Capitol, their attempt to overthrow our democracy and install the guy who lost, Trump, for a second term. We have the chaos of them being unable in the Capitol to even, you know, pick a Speaker of the House. You know, they can't even get that done. And guys like CJ want to, you know, claim that the world's out to get them and nobody will let them on the air, even though CJ's literally on the air every single day on, like, Devil's Advocates or other shows and your show.
I know.
I mean, nobody's stopping to talking, CJ. You're getting all the free speech you want on civic media. So, you know, it's just Republicans can't get out of their own way is the problem.
Yeah, man. Thank you very much for the call, as always, my friend. I really, really appreciate it. Go ahead, Sam.
Yeah, I had a reaction, though, that the CJ process bothers me, and the reason I was interested in today and cutting him off is that what we're trying to foster on the show is a discussion of policy and not a discussion of us versus them. And when CJ calls, we automatically shift to sort of what's wrong with CJ and what's wrong with them. And what's right with us? What we all need to be talking about is what do we need to do to make this place a better place for the middle class? What do we need to do to make this to make America work and hum like it can and like it should? And we can't if we reduce that to us versus them, we're never going to get there. And everyone understands that us versus them is at the heart of the problem we're experiencing in America today. It's part of the it's one of the reasons they can't pick a speaker.
Sandy, let me ask you. George Santos, whatever the guy's name is, the guy who just lied about everything.
Yeah, the one who won a Nobel Prize. And
So
was a Medal of Honor winner.
So I guess I have to ask you. I talked about him yesterday for the first time. I didn't think he was even worth having a conversation about. But I would say that the conversation about him is similar to the conversation that people had when the people lied about getting their children into college, right? With all the things going on, where does this rate?
Well, to be honest with you, though, I do think it's symptomatic, and he is symptomatic, of the disconnect the United States has had culturally from facts. And we've become connected rather than facts. We've become connected to so-called facts that are things we would prefer to believe in. This congressman told everyone that he has that his personal history was what he wished it was, rather than what it really was. And so he's like the hyperbolic logical extreme of what is happening to American culture, which is we're beginning to adopt a belief system that is the basis for our fact system. Our facts are based on beliefs, and typically it should be the other way around. Our beliefs are normally based primarily upon facts. And so this guy is totally disconnected from fact, obviously, and his disconnect started right there at home.
And wouldn't you say, Sandy, If I voted for a guy like that, I didn't know, I would be outspoken. I don't care whether he's Democrat or Republican.
Well, this is an example of the norms thing I was talking about. A norm we have is that people tell the truth about themselves.
Right.
And everyone might embellish. He wanted to call this embellishment. You know, this isn't embellishment. This is like completely manufactured self.
From beginning to end.
But there is no law about this with respect to running for office. He didn't violate a law by getting elected this way. The thing he's being investigated for is the fact that he set up a company that in turn that company gave a bunch of money to his political campaign. And the question is whether that company was a legitimate company or was it simply set up as a shell company for the purpose of raising money illegally for his campaign. And so he's being investigated for that, which is completely different than and apart from all of the lies that he concocted about and put into his resume and otherwise his public resume.
But you can't say on the other side of this, well, the Democrats lie too. You know, and so, but we need his vote. I mean, where that slippery slope, Sandy, is what we're talking about, right?
Well,
you
yes,
know that everything this man said was a flat-out lie. How are you going to trust him at all? And I don't know how a person like that guy can say, okay, I'm a congressperson now and sit in the halls of Congress and know that all these eyes are on you and people don't, and they know who and what you are.
I think Congress has the capacity to censor him in a manner that would cause him not to take his seat, and there would then be a special election. But the ability to, from a legal standpoint, to keep this man from taking office is very limited, and it's basically based on the electorate next time around not reelecting him. I mean, that's the—
I know, but he's got 2 years.
2 years, then. And so, you know, people need to vet people better, I suppose. His opposition should have done a better job of vetting him when they were running against him. But, yeah, it's a sorry circumstance. But, again, this is a question of a society when it loses its norms, we lose the capacity to operate smoothly because everything can't be decided in court. Everything can't be controlled by the police. Everything isn't controlled by the implementation of legal processes.
So we got to go to a break. We'll be right back.
Just keep on using me until you use me up.
Hey, baby, where you there with?
Hey!
We come through a lot of things, you know? So what happened to you? You make one little mistake, you want done us?
New Jasmine, let's go!
If I had you back in my world, I would prove that I could be a better girl. Oh, if you let me back in.
All right, welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show as always. You can join us at 844-967-2789. It's 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. It's Friday. My co-host Sandy Williams is in the studio. Sandy, you know, earlier we had a dialogue and a conversation about norms. And I asked you during the break about what has happened and what that actually means, that the norms that all of us grew up with have been breached.
Yeah.
And so what does that actually mean?
Well, increasingly society has dropped away from the norms. I mean, Donald Trump in his business life clearly operated outside the norms. Business is normally done by people on what is fundamentally a handshake basis. Yes, you have contracts that are designed to be able to solve an argument or a conflict over the business dealing in the off chance that you have a disagreement. But business people go to great pains to find people who are sitting on the other side of the table that they're doing business with, who they trust, who they believe they won't have an argument with, who they think will keep their word under the norms. Donald Trump didn't do that. He basically had over 5,300 litigation by the time he became president. His business history was, yeah, you don't like it, sue me. And everyone knew that. And so he was a businessman who operated outside the norms, and everyone knew it. And we became a politician and a leader. He became one who operated outside the social norms. Society as well has had norms which have been broken. Part of the polarization and fractionalization of America, we had a social norm, social settings. You don't talk about religion or politics in polite situations. Everyone knew that, but it became the point 10 years ago probably where social settings were no longer bounded by that, and actually socially we began to break down, and people who were liberals couldn't socialize with people who were conservatives because you couldn't have social a genteel, civilized social discourse without breaking down into vitriolic, strident arguments. And society has broken down in that fashion. We've turned into us against them because of our incapacity to carry out the civilized norms that we had of reasonable discussion.
Let me dare I interject that maybe part of why this is as transpired is the lack of moral involvement with people who've fallen away from, you know, whatever people believe to be their spiritual beliefs. You know, way back then, we had a society that, whether right or wrong, had that kind of context.
I kind of think, be honest with you, that this has to do with mutual respect for a society that's based on mutual respect and civility. And I'm not sure that that has anything to do with church and civility. I think it has more to do with a relaxation of civilized rules. You know, it was probably in the late 1960s, you'd go to a restaurant and they would ask you for your name. And it used to be that you'd give your last name, which was the civilized, genteel approach. And it became, you give your first name. And then in social settings, it developed that when you introduced yourself to someone, you used to introduce yourself. I'm Earl Ingram.
Right.
Now it's just Earl. No, we don't want to get to know one another. We don't observe the social norms. We used to get dressed with coat and tie because that was a sign of respect for the people you were dealing with. We dropped all that into great informality. Now, I'm not for artificial formality, other than the extent to which that artificial formality might be a reflection of a mutual respect that we need to maintain regardless of how we dress or how we address one another. And I think what's happened is over the last 20 years that our civilized norms have dropped mutual respect and we no longer are observing it in almost any aspect of our life. We don't have as much respect for our elders and for our as other right. other cultures do. And we've just dropped respect in so many ways in our culture that I think it's caused us to become very fractionalized.
So let's talk about the long-term ramifications of that, because I kind of maintain that you kind of see it in everyday life where, and I'm, you know, I've gotten to the point where I'm talking about the differences from 70, 60 years ago and 50 years ago, and that people, you know, were more willing to have dialogue and conversations with one another. There weren't shouting matches. You could have disagreement, and that disagreement didn't escalate into something like it is today. Because both people understood there's give and take in a conversation, and I don't have to scream and yell at you. We have differences. But in 40 years ago, 50 years ago, you could have that kind of a conversation.
Yeah, I think that the system, particularly political dialogue, was less fundamentally premised on something you would call ideological belief and was more premised on sort of a policy differential and a different way of looking at the same set of facts. But we've lost contact with facts, and the facts that people look at and believe in are different. So when you and I get into an argument. We might be arguing about something which we don't even have a fundamental agreement about the facts regarding it. And then we address it from the standpoint of an ideological belief, so that the discussion with some of the people who are call-ins, I'm not going to use the name because I don't want to get into the we they thing, but a number of our callers might call in and they only want to address from a belief point and a partisan ideological point, a policy question.
All right, we've got to go to the break. 844-967-2789. We'll be right back.
Oh, darling, I wanted to be everything to you.
You are everything.
You are everything. All right, welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. That's 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. It's Friday. That's Fridays with Sandy Williams. You know, Sandy, I want to go to the young football player that DeMar Hamlin and what happened to him. And from the standpoint of what is it about our nation that when that happened, you kind of saw a coming together of people, be they Democrat, Republicans, didn't matter, Christian, Muslim, black, white, male, female. People saw that and came together and said, oh, my, what a tragedy, you know. And they put all these other things on the back burner. Because of that situation, it was one of those coming together moments. Well, why can't we do it for things that I'm not saying that's not important.
No, but I think you've hit on something, which is, you know, that's a humanized issue. Everyone saw instantaneously the humanized problem that everyone could understand and everyone has faced in some respect in their life or could expect to realize or experience. And so that brings it home. And I think the problem with our political leadership is they fail to bring home those things which are shared experiences by so many people. The thing that Tom calls in about that I was talking about, the plight of the middle class today and the budget they face and the inability to receive health care. The inability of a broad group of people to receive the nutrition they need, the health care, the child daycare that is required, the inability of children born into our country to get all of the opportunities they ought to have. All of those things bear the same potential tragic aspects to them that DeMar Hamlin's health issue had. I mean, his was life and death. These other things are different than life and death, but not altogether different in terms of what they do to quality of life and what they do to society generally. And yet we haven't humanized those, and we can humanize DeMar Hamlin. I think the lesson from this is let's get on with humanizing these other things, and let's bring them home. Let's get people to look at them with compassion and empathy, and then we can start getting things done.
So because apparently that's still within the human being, compassion and sympathy, because here this young guy was trying to raise $2,500 for Christmas toys for kids.
Yeah.
And that was a struggle for him to raise the $2,500.
What is it at now? Millions that were raised?
Inside of one day, it was $5 million. So the compassion and the capacity of that in human beings still exists.
Well, all of human nature resides in us. And so, you know, we've, for a while, I think we like to believe that we've erased greed and avarice and some of those bad things that exist. And we haven't. Okay, those things continue to reside, at least potentially, in all of us. But also resident in all of us are these good things, empathy and sympathy and the ability to exercise compassion. And so, you know, we need to keep a grip on, we need to start fanning the flames of empathy and compassion and stop fanning the flames of fear and anger, okay? Because what's happened politically is we've taken human nature, the fear and anger part of it, and we've played up on it, and we've decided, at least some people have decided, to downplay and not work on the compassion, empathy, and sympathy portion of it. Now, incidentally, the young guy, I just was looking at the phone, seeing the most recent news, and it's fantastic. I mean, apparently, DeMar no longer has a breathing tube. Apparently, minutes ago, was addressing his team via Zoom call, and is making a remarkable recovery. So,
you know, Sandy, it has to be that because people were able to see this, because the television stations and everybody were able, even if you didn't see it that night, you saw this, the magnitude of it, all of the athletes, all of the players praying, and the impact of what this one young man's life had, and it touched people in a way that maybe some of these other things, you know, people don't get to see or don't get to hear. Maybe it's the fact that they saw this with their own eyes. And maybe, I don't know if that matters.
Oh, it certainly mattered. And I think seeing it with their own eyes, I think that was part of the humanization of it. It brought it home. But what we need to do is start bringing home to people the plight of others so that we can start fanning compassion, sympathy, and empathy, and stop in government playing up fear and anger, because really what's driven us apart has been fear and anger. And I would, again, both sides have participated in fanning the flames of fear and anger. And what we need to do is take the DeMar Hamlin example to heart and realize that we need to redeploy all of the kind of feelings we had about him, redeploy it to one another.
Well, clearly, it still exists within people.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's a human condition that we're all born with, I think, right?
Yeah, and it's a good one.
Yeah.
Yeah,
go ahead.
No, I mean, I just think that we should all recognize that goodness resides in us, and goodness resides in everybody, and a conservative should understand that there's goodness in liberals and vice versa.
Well,
and we could start talking to one another with a recognition that what's sitting on the other side of the table having this discussion with us is a good person.
You know, Well, thank you, Sandy. It's good to know that.
I just came to that I suddenly woke up to this, Earl. My God.
But I'll tell you something. What made me want to even, you know, talk about
it
I was reading this morning an article in Newsweek, and it was about Tucker Carlson. And he was explaining why something has happened to him that he just disdains liberal people. I mean, he's got a hatred. I don't know what liberal people ever did to Tucker Carlson.
I wonder what you have to be a liberal to fall into that category.
I know. And maybe he had a moment where he collected his thoughts and said, hey, why do I hate somebody? And he used the verbiage hate. And this was starting to consume him. Well, yeah. You can't, you know, I don't sit around saying I hate conservatives. What do I gain out of saying I dislike conservatives to the degree that it overtakes who I am? To me, that's a sickness in the spirit of who you are. Yes, Tucker Carlson's a financially secured person who will never have to worry about another dollar a day in his life. He's still relatively young enough. He's famous. He's got all of these things that one would hope to obtain, and yet he's not happy because he's got this hatred in him. what? For people who disagree with him politically. Isn't there something wrong with that?
Well, yeah, but it's symptomatic. I mean, there's lots of people not as lucky as Tucker Carlson financially who share that same kind of hatred. And sitting on both sides of the ideological argument that hate one another. And it's what I'm talking about. It's this. It's the fact that we, instead of recognizing the goodness of the intent and purpose of the person who you're discussing things with, you can only recognize the difference, which brings out in you anger and fear. And like I've said before, there is this fear that we've developed the ideological argument to the point that people believe that the other side is going to tear apart the fabric of America and destroy what it is that America is, to the point that they're willing to bear arms to defeat the movement, the transition of government to that other side. So the people on January 6th thought that Joe Biden posed such a risk to America that they were willing to do what they did on January 6th to try and stop the orderly transition of power done pursuant to the laws, because their view was that Joe Biden had no business being in residing in the office of president.
But see, Sandy, the part of that that I can never reconcile is that's their idea of what America should be. Their idea of what America should be has no more value than the what the other side, what their idea of what America should be, that the weight, the value of them are the same in a nation like this. So when you start personalizing, that's mine, this is my America, Sandy, that's where we're really at this tipping point.
I think the tipping point starts with militia thinking, okay? There's people in America who think in terms of militia, who think in terms of essentially bearing arms to avoid America being taken over by
other Americans,
by people who are going to tear their version of America apart. People that Lou from Cudahy would accuse of being Marxists. So if you accuse someone of being a Marxist, you're basically saying that you are someone that I would basically bear arms against rather than let you take over America, because that's the way that term has always been used. Communist Marxists used to go to jail for the very reason that that's what they were.
But Sandy, again, that's your fellow countrymen, right? After it's all said and done, you ignore and dismiss the fact that that's your fellow countrymen. And you're willing to dismiss all of that parts of it because what you see in your mind, dismissing the fact that what's in your mind, I mean, those are your thoughts.
Well, this has to do with the norms and civility. Now we're getting back to that, because the norms and civility are that people have disagreements, that the government might move from one ideological viewpoint to another, but it's our government and it's all something that we participate in. That being a loyal American means that we're loyal to the American processes, including the transition of power from liberals to conservatives and vice versa. That's a norm, okay?
Right.
The orderly transition of power was actually a norm. There were very few, as we found out, there were very few laws written very clearly that made it absolutely abundantly clear just exactly how that transpires and what the powers were.
So let's do this. Let's go to Paul. Good morning, Paul. Thank you very much for the call. You say what?
Good morning, gentlemen. Thanks for your show. I don't understand what happened on January 6th completely. It was an armed revolution, to speak. But I believe some of this is to do with Fox. I don't call it news, but it's Fox. Some of it is also to blame right-wing radio that worked people up into a frenzy. You can have dialogue, but it has to be civilized. And for what right-wing radio and Fox does, that's you just can't do things like that, or shouldn't be doing things like that. And what really frightens me, Sandy and Earl, is this dialogue is still going on. You still have people calling in death threats, threatening people. Right. You're seeing it in Congress right now, and I don't know where this is going to end, because I'm sure I grew up in the same time you guys did, and we've seen assassinations and everything else, but I never seen anybody try to overthrow the government. So that's my take. Somewhere along the line, I think Biden, by the way, is doing a good job of trying to bring people together. But all right, thanks for listening to
Paul,
me today.
Hey, Paul, where are you from?
I'm from the Madison area.
Okay. Thank you very much for the call. I really appreciate it. Listen, we've got to go to a break. 844-967-2789. We'll be right back. All right. Welcome back to what I can't believe is the last few minutes of the Earl Ingram Show. And you know, and it's Friday with Sandy Williams. Sandy, this is the first show of the new year, first week of the new year. And
In fact, I had to write 2023 yesterday. I took some money out of the bank and was like, holy, yeah. Now usually have trouble even writing the number.
Right. And so we're off and running. Tom. Yes, sir.
Sandy, here's what I would say. Number one, I don't know any liberal person that actually truly hates regular Republican people. I do know Republicans that absolutely do hate liberals. I mean, we see them on TV every day. But what I don't understand is that I don't agree with the policies of the conservatives, and I don't agree with the fact that a lot of them, or most of them, all the Republicans, are basically bought off by the billionaire class so they can write a tax code where someone like Donald Trump can pay less taxes than I pay in one paycheck.
Well, Tom, they're Democrats who are, you know, clearly they're in on that too. Not all, but there's certainly some.
No, absolutely. That's what I'm saying. Because of money and politics, they're in on it too. Exactly, because that's the game. But what I don't understand is, you know, when I call up, I always say we the people are the government. That means everybody. That doesn't mean we're leaving out conservatives or we're leaving out, you know, people that are from the patchwork of, you know, of people. That means everyone. And I do believe that we all need to get along. But I also believe that the billionaire class, and I say that because there's 3 billionaires in this country that own more wealth than 70% of the American people. And that they want us to be fighting each other and have food fights with each other. And the corporate media, whether it's on the MSNBC or it's on Fox, they all want that too, because that gives them ratings. I'm just trying to figure out how it is that we can get to a point. And I think one of the ways that you can do it is with your $60,000 deal. And I know I keep on harping on it, but it's the one way that maybe we can wake up some Americans. And also, yeah.
Well, the only thing I would contradict you about is too much focus on what you call the billionaire class. The 3 people who have more assets and more net worth than all the wealth held by everyone else in America is those people are probably not the champions of the policies in government, which are so troublesome.
But they buy off the government.
I don't even think those 3 are so busily buying off government. But I think that what is happening is that all of the private interests, each one of them pursuing their own private interests, has created this pork barrel, which is the Internal Revenue Code, and which has created a government which is not meeting the needs of the people. And so if we oversimplify it and say what we're worried about are these 3 billionaires and the evil things they're doing in the dark room, we're missing the boat, because what's really happening is it's our employers. It's many of the things which are much more local to us, the private interests, that are through their lobbyists doing things which run contrary to what we want and need, and so the money in politics.
Well, we know that they want to.
The money.
Can we agree that they basically want to privatize everything?
Well, there are those who want to privatize everything, and that's a problem. But there are those who simply want to expand the military budget to make sure that there are Oshkosh truck things being sold. And I'm not trying to vilify Oshkosh truck any more than Lockheed Martin or anybody else.
There's
every kind of employer. Every kind, you know, there's the lumber and tree business who wants to make sure that the tax code gives them some big breaks. And it's the country is replete with all of that stuff. And all of that stuff is what is preoccupying the time of the people who go and create our laws. And they are not spending any of their time on universal child daycare, on universal health care.
Right.
So Sandy, so all of those entities that are preoccupying the time of our elected officials mean that then they don't have time to deal with the people who put them in office. That's my big problem with all of this.
Yes, absolutely.
I wouldn't be sitting down with the lobbyists if we hadn't elected them.
I'm not disagreeing with any of that. I just happen to have a personal problem with trying to elevate the notion of a billionaire class into being the people we're against. The fact that they exist is probably the result of a bunch of policies we've put in place about in the tax code, for instance, and the ability to accumulate wealth without paying taxes during the process of accumulation or sufficient taxes. Yes, we've probably accelerated the rate at which they can get their wealth, but I don't think that any of those people who accumulated it were privy to or a part of, for instance, the capital gains process. William Gates, I'm confident, had nothing to do with lobbying for that, and I'm not sure Jeff Bezos
did. Sandy,
yes?
Let me ask you this question. Which party, because at the end of the day, we have two political parties in this country mainly. So what party is going to get us Medicare for all, more on their platform, and child care for all, and other life-saving things? Is it the Democratic Party or is it the Republican Party?
Let me say this, because I think both Democrats and Republicans, when we're talking about lobbyists, both are guilty of sitting down 100% listening to the lobbyists more than they're listening to their constituents and the people.
And as we close, a quick answer to your question is, based on the way government currently operates with the rules on cloture, it's going to take both Republicans and Democrats to adopt it. I do think the Democrats in the current setting of things will be the moving force to bring to the public the information they need to start generating the political motive for universal health care, for instance, or universal child daycare. And it'll probably hopefully be on the kind of factual basis that you and I have discussed about the plight of the middle class. But ultimately, the pressure is going to have to be sufficient to cause Republicans as well to see that it's necessary to get it adopted. And so, you know, ultimately it's going to require some bipartisanship. But yes, you're right. I think the motivating force is going to have to come from the left, but they're going to have to abandon the current way they approach it, and they're going to have to approach it much more on the basis of socioeconomic groupings.
All right, listen, we got to go. Thank everybody who made the show. Go, Sandy, thank you again for another great couple days. We'll be back on Monday. Sandy, I guess I'll see you again then.
Yeah, this time it'll be Monday. And
Tuesday. Have a great weekend. Thank you, Connor, for all the hard work. Thank you all for listening. You've been tuned into the Earl Ingram Show. See you later.